Reading from Shemot Avim Canto 4, chapter 21, verse 35. Pradana kala saya dharma sangrahe. Sarira esha pratipadya
chetanam.
Kriya falatvena vibhu vibhavyate. Yatana lo daru shutad gur atmakaha. Pradana kala saya dharma sangrahe. Sarira esha pratipadya chetana. Kriya falat vena vibhur vibhavyate. Yatana lo darushu tad gunatmaka. Pradana, material nature. Kala, time, asaya, desire, dharma, occupation of duties, sangrahe, aggregate, sarire, body, esha, this, pratipadya, accepting, chaitanam,
consciousness.
Kriya activities.
Palatvena,
by the results of.
Vibhu,
Supreme Personality of Godhead.
The
Vibhavyate,
manifested.
Yata,
as much as.
Anula,
fire.
Darushu,
in the wood.
According to shape and quality. Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, but He is also manifested in different types of bodies which arise from the combination of material nature, time, desires, and occupational duties. Thus, different types of consciousness develop, just as fire, which is always basically the same, blazes in different ways according to the shape and dimension of firewood. Purport. The Supreme Personality of God constantly lives with the individual soul as Paramatma. The individual soul has awareness in accord with his material body, which he attains by virtue of property or material nature. The material ingredients are activated by the force of time, and thus the three material modes of nature are manifested. According to his association with the three modes of nature, the living entity develops a particular type of body. In animal life, the material mode of ignorance is so prominent, there is very little chance of realizing the Paramatma who is present within the heart of the animal. But in the human form of life, because of developed consciousness, or chaitanam, one can be transferred from ignorance and passion to goodness by the result of his activities, kriya, philatena. A human being is therefore advised to associate with spiritually advanced personalities. The Vedas give the direction, tat vijnanartham sa gurum eva bhikachet. In order to reach the perfection of life, or to understand the real constitutional position of the living entity, one must approach spiritual master. Gurum eva abhigacchet. One must. It is not optional. It is imperative that one approach the spiritual master, for by such association, one proportionately develops his consciousness toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The highest perfection of such consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. According to the body given by property or nature, one's consciousness is present. According to the development of consciousness, one's activities are performed. And according to the purity of such activities, one realizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is present in everyone's heart. An example given herein is very appropriate. Fire is always the same, but according to the size of the fuel and burning wood, the fire appears to be straight, curved, small, big, etc. According to the development of consciousness, God realization is present in the human form of life. It is recommended, therefore, that one undergo the different types of penances and austerities described in Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. Like a staircase, yoga has different steps for reaching the topmost floor. And according to one's position upon the staircase, he is understood to be situated in Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga. Of course, Bhakti Yoga is the topmost step on the staircase of realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, according to one's development and consciousness, one realizes his spiritual identity. And thus, when one's existential position is pure and fully, he becomes situated in Brahmananda, which is ultimately unlimited. Therefore, the Sankirtan movement contributed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is the direct and easiest process for coming to the purest form of consciousness, Krishna consciousness, the platform on which the Supreme Personality is fully realized. Directions for performing different types of yajnas are specifically arranged for the highest realization of the Supreme Lord, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita by the Lord Himself. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is realized according to the proportion of one's surrender. Full surrender, however, occurs when a man is perfectly in knowledge. Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, but he is also manifested in different types of bodies which arise from the combination of material nature, time, desires, and occupational duties. Thus, different types of consciousness develop, just as fire, which is basically the same, blazes in different ways according to the shape and dimension of firewood. So here we have a description of the Supreme Lord in the form of this one word, Vibhu, in the third line. So Vibhu means great. Often it is translated as all-pervading. Because if it's all-pervading, it must be the biggest. It's everywhere. So therefore it's the greatest, the biggest. So the Lord is Vibhu. But here it says that he also manifests through matter and time, etc., material ingredients. So the Lord is all-pervading, but he takes limited forms. Matter is ultimately limited, and we get different forms in this material world. So that's not Vibhu at all. It's quite different. Moreover, the Lord is fully conscious, whereas matter is completely unconscious. So, how does the Lord manifest in the form of material objects and material bodies, etc.? So, it's not directly the Supreme Lord, but in our philosophy, we have what is called Achintya Bheda Bheda. We make differentiation between matter and God and jivas, but at the same time, we also say they're one, Abheda. So in that sense, material energy and the bodies that are created and the jivas in the material world are expansions of the Lord. At the same time, they're not exactly the Supreme Lord. They're also different from the Supreme Lord. So this verse describes how the one all-pervading Lord manifests in terms of material bodies with jivas with that limited consciousness. This obviously is not the Supreme Lord because he can never be contaminated or limited or conditioned by material nature or have material bodies. But because it's all part of the Supreme Lord, we say it's the Supreme Lord. So he expands as material energy and the jivas, and the jivas in a conditioned state in this material world. It's part of the Lord, but it's not the same as the Lord exactly, because the Lord is never conditioned. So therefore everything is part of the Supreme Lord, but at the same time, different. So, once we have jivas manifesting themselves in the material world, the jivas become attached to material bodies. And according to the type of body, they are limited in different ways. How do they get that particular body? Because of karma. They are placed in that particular body with the particular qualities because of previous activities. So the attachment of a particular jiva, a particular body, is not random. It is not by chance. It is very precisely decided by the previous activities of a person, what he deserves. So each jiva gets a particular body in this world. Some jivas get plant bodies. They cannot move. And they don't have eyes, they don't have ears, so their sense perception is very limited. Other jivas take animal bodies. So they legs, they move around, have some sort of intelligence. But even that intelligence is quite limited. They're not self-aware. They don't think of the future much, or beyond what happens tomorrow or the next day. They can't think of what happens next year, whatever, 20 years from now. Memory power is very sharp, whatever. When we come to the human being, on the other hand, then human being has much greater intelligence, greater memory, more emotions, and also more attachments, more material attachments as well. More opportunities for sense gratification than animals. So human being has more capacity in all sorts of ways, intellectually and emotionally and sensual, etc. All of this is decided by karma, previous activities of jiva. So this last line describes how wood manifests differently according to the fire atom manifests differently according to the wood. So we have a little piece of wood, and then fire manifests in one way. We need a lot of wood, manifests in a bigger way. We have a deepa, little lamp. And then we have a huge bonfire. Different. It's all fire, but manifests differently according to the wood or the fuel. So, similarly, the jivas are in different bodies, but they manifest consciousness differently according to that particular body and the particular gunas. So they appear quite different because of that. So there is great variety in the material world because of the variety of bodies and the variety of jivas and the variety of their karmas. Nevertheless, it's all related to the Supreme Lord, though indirectly. It's all related to the Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord is most powerful. He is everywhere. He is all-pervading. He is the biggest. He has all knowledge. Here we have these jivas stuck in bodies in the material world with very limited intelligence, limited bodies, subject to birth, death, old age, and disease. Quite different. Nevertheless, they are related. So, what is that relationship? This becomes a big subject, a big problem, actually, in religion. Because we have these limited jivas, and then we have Supreme Lord, who is completely opposite in many ways, all-pervading, all-knowledgeable, etc. Why would we have such a difference? Why can't the jivas be like the Supreme Lord? Why can't they be equal to the Supreme Lord? But why is the Supreme Lord so repressive and authoritarian and unmerciful that he doesn't give us the privilege of being like him? This is a question that people could ask. And they do ask, if God is all merciful, then why do we have to suffer in this material world, birth and death, etc.?
for some people, it becomes a very critical question, so that they even reject God because they can't figure out why we're so limited in misery, subject to misery in this world. If there's a God, then he should take us out of this world. So this is a problem in religion and philosophy, a relationship of God to this material world and how he interacts with it. And there's many ways in which we can solve this problem. Some religions don't solve the problem too nicely, so people have a lot of doubt about those religions because of that. In the Bhagavatam and in the Vedic literature, there's a very nice explanation why this is like, why the jivas are in this position, why the Supreme Lord is in that position. So, why the Lord makes the jiva suffer. So, actually the Lord doesn't make the jiva suffer at all. The jiva makes himself suffer. He is the cause of his own suffering. And if he doesn't want to have suffering, he doesn't have to have suffering either. This is why we call it the jiva tatashta shakti. Tatashta means borderline. He can be either. He can be suffering in the material world, or he can be have eternal bliss in the spiritual world. He can do either. It's not that the Lord makes the jiva suffer in the material world or enjoy in the spiritual world. It's the choice of the jiva. In the material world, the jiva makes choices and he suffers. So the direct cause of the suffering is karma. If you cause suffering, you get suffering. The more suffering you cause to other living entities, the more suffering you get on yourself. So this is the law of the material world. And the other law is the more compassion you show to other living entities, the more comforts you get in life. So it's a very just law. It goes both ways. Bad activities, bad results. Good activities, good results. So it's up to the jiva to decide what type of activities he should do. And to make it a little easier, if you're an animal or a plant, you're not responsible at all. You don't have to choose. You don't get any karma at all. It's only as a human being that you're responsible for your activity because you've got more intelligence. It's like a baby is not responsible for, you know, if it does something wrong. And an adult is responsible to do some wrong activity. So, human beings have this responsibility. So, human being is the cause of all the suffering. If he's suffering now, what caused it? His previous activities of violence, causing suffering to others. If he's enjoying nicely now, what is the cause? Again, himself. He did good activities, so he gets good result now. But it is somewhat unpredictable because we have so many karmas. In fact, there's so many karmas we cannot count the number of karmas that are waiting for us for next life and next life and next life and next life and next life. Even if we don't do any activities this life, we've still got all piles of karma to enjoy or suffer in our future lifetimes. And we're accumulating new karmas all the time because we're acting all day long, every day of our life. So how many activities do you do in one day? You cannot count because you're doing things all, you're breathing, you're walking, you're moving. There's so many activities all day long. And you're getting karmas for all that. Every day, even when you're sleeping, you're getting karmas by rolling over in bed. You squish an insect or something, you get a karma for that. You breathe in an insect, you get a karma for that. You drink some water, there's a bug in it, you get some karma for that. Light a fire, your karma for that, for destroying some insect or something. So all day long, when you walk on the street, or whatever you do, you're affecting other living entities somehow or other. And you're getting karma for every single thing, all continuously, day and night, for all your life. And that gives results in future lifetimes. And we got so many karmas, we can't burn up all of our karmas in one lifetime. So we got more lifetimes and more lifetimes to go through. We're always accumulating, and we burn up a little, and we're accumulating more karma. So, endless cycle. So, it's described that this cycle of karma can go on. It's actually anadi. no beginning, but it can have an end. And so this is where the jiva's choice comes. You can end this karma that which causes all your suffering in this world. Two ways you can do it: get liberation, end up in Brahman, and destroy your karma through jnana or yoga. A very difficult process, but you can do that. And the other is through bhakti, which is easier. For Ajamayali just chanted the name of Narayan, all his karmas were gone. So bhakti is an easier process. But the whole idea of bhakti is not to get rid of your karmas at all, whereas that is the whole process for jnana and yoga: get rid of karmas and get liberation. So the process of bhakti, easily get rid of all those. So that problem of suffering in the world, why do we suffer? Well, it's not that God is arranging for us to suffer. We create the circumstances for our own suffering by our own activities. And as a human being, then we should choose to do proper activities so we don't suffer. One is the good activities or the bad activities. We get the balance in which we get more enjoyment than suffering in life. Okay, then not really solved, but because we still have a body, we still have birth and death, but we minimize. The other solution is to go for jnana, yoga, or bhakti, and permanently eradicate material bodies, all material activities, through moksha, liberation, or through going to spiritual world and getting prema. So these are the ways, things we can choose. We can, if we want to just choose to get better karma and enjoy material, we do karma yoga. Do maximum of punya, pious activities, and minimize the sin. This is what karma yoga does. And of course, then we don't have to suffer. It is said if you go to Brahma Loka, it is so nice, it's almost like spiritual world. You do have a material body, and after billions of years or whatever, Brahma's life, then you have to die also and get that suffering. But it's relatively no old age for a long time, you don't age, and you don't have any suffering as such, just that you have to die eventually after a long period of time. That's the result of karma yoga. But if you're more intelligent, as Krishna teaches us in Bhagavad Gita, better get rid of your material body completely. So then you can get liberation in Brahman, where you simply sit there with no body at all, gross or subtle, or you can go to the spiritual world, and there you get prema and get bliss. So this is all the choice of the jiva. He can stay in the material world, he can suffer if he wants to, he can choose karma yoga, get less suffering in the material world, or he can get rid of the suffering completely through jnana yoga or bhakti. So, therefore, it's not that the Lord creates this problem for the jiva. The jiva creates it, and the jiva can solve. Jiva has to solve the problem. Unfortunately, the jivas are rather helpless because they're all covered by ignorance. They got all their karmas, and they're so confused. They don't know what they're doing. So, therefore, the Lord has to help the jivas, and that's where the mercy of the Lord is. He is not neutral. He is compassionate. So the whole purpose of the Bhagavatam is to show how the Lord makes arrangements for the jivas in the material world to get them out. First of all, he gives them opportunity to enjoy the material world. How does he do that? He gives them different lokas. You have all these lower lokas like Patala Loka and Sutala Loka and lower planet. But that's also enjoyment for some jivas. They like that. Then we have our place here, which is kind of in the middle, Bhumandala, where you get a mixture. And then you have the upper planets, where you get more and more enjoyment, more and more enjoyment, until you get to Brahmaloka, where you get the most material enjoyment. And Brahma makes you bodies, according to your karma, so you can go to each planet and enjoy on those particular planets. If you don't have that body, you cannot enjoy on that particular planet. So they, according to your karma, you get a particular type of body to enjoy in Svargaloka, particular body to enjoy here on Earth planet, particular body to enjoy in the lower planets like Sutala Loka or Patala Loka, and suitable body to enjoy in Brahmaloka. So the Lord makes this arrangement for the jivas in terms of bodies, and then he makes arrangements to advance. So one of the things is dharma, avoid sinful activity, do karma yoga, varnashram, etc. How does he do that? He empowers manus to establish a whole system of varnashram, and the manu is the king. And he has descendants for 71 yuga cycles of this. And after that, then another manu appears, and he carries on for another 71 yuga cycles. Throughout the day of Brahma, we have a whole series of manus and their descendants instituting varnashram dharma to avoid the sins and get the punyas, so that you can get maximum enjoyment and minimum suffering. That's the karma yoga system. Also, the manus are devotees, empowered by the Supreme Lord. So they also teach bhakti. And then we have sages who teach jnana. There are different, vibhutis of the Lord. Manus are specially empowered by the Lord to rule over and spread dharma and bhakti. And the sages are there. They're also empowered. Rishis. So they're empowered with knowledge. Some of them teach karma yoga, some teach jnana yoga or astanga yoga. So the sages are empowered to teach the human beings also. So therefore we get all these processes being delivered to the human beings so that they can advance. And of course, then individual devotees are there who teach bhakti. And repeatedly, the Bhagavatam glorifies the devotees as the, mediums by which bhakti is manifested in this world. And we have different devotees. And then we have special devotees like Narada Muni who come, who is Shaktivesh avatar, and he's empowered to spread bhakti everywhere. And then we have processes. So we have, of course, the bhakti processes, non-sankirtan, etc. And then we have Supreme Lord Himself coming and teaching. So the Lord comes and teaches Bhagavad Gita to give us instructions. He displays His pastimes as Krishna, which are recorded in Bhagavatam, to inspire us. So the Lord doesn't abandon the jiva at all in the material world. He's very compassionate, and He makes all sorts of arrangements to help the jiva choose, make proper choices. If the jiva doesn't choose, of course, then don't blame the Supreme Lord. So jiva, he chooses. He must choose what to do. Throughout the day of Brahma, every day of Brahma, for Brahma's 100 years, all these choices are there for the jiva. The manu appears, Swayambhuva appears at the beginning of Brahma's day, and he goes on for 71 yuga cycles, then another manu comes, and they're sublime. All throughout the day, we have the avatars appearing all throughout the day. And some even last for a whole Manvantara period. That's the Manvantara avatar. Like Vamanadeva is for this Vaivasvata manu. He's always present in this material world. Now he's in Sutala Loka, whatever. But he's always present for the whole manu. Then we have the Yuga avatars. Every Yuga we get an avatar coming and teaching the Yuga Dharma. So the Lord is very merciful all through the lifetime of Brahma. To elevate the jivas through karma, jnana, yoga, and finally bhakti. So in this way the Lord actually is very compassionate to all the jivas in this material world, and He gives them the opportunity to choose all through the day of Brahma, throughout Brahma's life. So we should not criticize the Lord for being indifferent to the jivas. He makes all sorts of arrangements. Nevertheless, the jiva is a jiva, so the Lord gives him some independence. He doesn't force the jiva to do one thing or the other. He gives the jiva choice. And that's, as I said, unfortunately for the jiva, they're not very intelligent. They're rather habituated to this material world, and they're a little bit lazy. So it takes them a long time to take advantage of any opportunity that the Lord gives in terms of mercy in this material world. We see the Lord comes in this material world as avatar. Some of us take advantage, many do not. And when Krishna comes, the most attractive avatar, all these asuras are looking at him and insulting him. They don't accept him. Even he's there, they refuse to accept him. We'll just speak of when others are there. The devotees, of course, are there. And then the people just ignore them or insult them also. So unfortunately, the jivas are rather hard-headed and too conditioned to this material world to take advantage. Nevertheless, over time and exposure, then the jiva gradually begins to change. It's a slow process for many jivas. So for that reason, the jiva gets many, many, many lifetimes, body after body after body in the material world. So you can get many, many chances throughout the day of Brahma, throughout the lifetime of Brahma. So the Lord therefore makes arrangements for the jivas so that they can make proper choices. He gives opportunities to them at all times. So we should never accuse the Lord of being cruel or indifferent or whatever. So the reward for the jiva is that, in spite of the fact that the jiva is limited and covered by material nature, through the process of bhakti, the jiva can completely get rid of all these coverings of material bodies and subtle body and karma, etc. Not only that, the jiva can develop a spiritual body, which is very unique to bhakti. It does not take place with jnana and yoga. You don't get a spiritual body. You're just atma, stuck in Brahman, in no particular form. And if you do bhakti, then you get a particular form with senses and mind and intelligence in the spiritual world. And you can relate with the Supreme Lord, perceive the Lord, serve the Lord, carry out activities with the Lord. So that is the special unique quality of bhakti. Through bhakti, then you develop perceptions of all sorts. And what's the use of that? So that, one, you can serve the Lord. Two, you can experience bliss. So in the material world, we're always complaining, well, why the Lord's so cruel that he doesn't make us happy and he keeps suffering for us, etc. Well, the answer is that the Lord will give you opportunity so you can get only happiness and no suffering at all in the spiritual world. And you do that with your spiritual body. And so it's not that you're simply inert and kind of almost unconscious, as in Brahman, you're just conscious of being conscious, that's it. Your consciousness, that's all. So spiritual world is something like here, you're conscious of things, but it gives rise to eternal bliss. It doesn't give rise to karma and suffering or whatever in the material world. So the Lord gives this opportunity to experience highest bliss eternally. And that's His great compassion. If we follow the proper process. So here in the Purport, Prabhupada mentions how you go through a certain process that is associated with spiritually advanced personalities. And then it goes from the Mandaka Upanishad. In order to get vijnana, tad vijnana, artum, for the purpose of getting knowledge and realizations of tad, which could be either Brahman or Supreme Lord, you must surrender, you must approach Guru. It doesn't say Dikshit Guru, we have to go to some Guru. This, of course, is the Vedic system where you have to go to the Guru to get Vedic knowledge, because there was no books anyway, no internet, nothing there. If you wanted some knowledge about anything, you have to go to somebody else to get it. It's all oral. And if you have to go to the Guru for Vedas, then you have to be qualified. And if you're not qualified, he won't even tell you anything. So you depend on another person to get your knowledge of all sorts of things in this world. And particularly to get Vedic knowledge, then you have to go to the Guru. And if he thinks you're qualified, then he gives you the knowledge. So very necessary to have that Guru for getting Vedic knowledge. Otherwise, it's secret. You're not going to get it at all. So, of course, in the modern day, that secret is not there. The Vedas are all public. You can read the Vedas, you can chant Om or Gayatri Mantra publicly or whatever. It's not secret anymore. But we should not think that because of that, therefore, the knowledge is there. That the words are there, but it's a little different. Because unless you receive the word properly, it doesn't have its potency. So you can, as Padma Purana says, you know, if you get the scripture from the mouth of a person who has no faith in the Lord, then it's like poison. It doesn't have the potency, spiritual potency. It gives it material potency only, which material potency means poison. They don't encourage you to enjoy the material world instead of getting the real spiritual import. So the delivery of the word of scripture depends on the person who gives it. It's not just the sound, which you could pick up anywhere. If you get from the wrong person or the wrong source, then no value. You can get it from the person who's a devotee, Vaishnava, then has potency in it. Okay? So that refers to scripture. It also refers to mantra. Mantras have to be received through proper source. And of course, Vedas are mantras also. So, unless they're received from the proper source, who is a person who has some realization of them, then no value, or very little value, or wrong value. They can become material value. So, therefore, we have to go to the proper person to get the knowledge. Huh? Now, the name of the Lord is a little unique. So mantras, even Vaishnava mantras, we have to go to Guru. That's why we have Diksha. We get mantras and then we can worship the deity. Yeah? But Harinam, you can hear loudly. And we chant it loudly. You don't need Guru for that. Yeah? And this has become the Yuga Dharma. Yeah? So you don't need initiation for that. And Lord Chaitanya went around and he said, you simply chant the holy name. He didn't give initiation. Chant. Finish. Instruct everybody to chant. So the name of the Lord is very special in that sense. It doesn't require the guru. Huh? But then there's a little qualification. If you want to get prema, then you need guru also. The name has potency, as in the case of Ajamil, to destroy karmas, etc. If you don't have a guru, Ajamil didn't have a guru. His name was Sanarayana. Didn't know bhakti even. But he destroyed karma. So the name has potency in any case, whether it's a guru or no guru. If you chant intentionally with some sort of devotion, but you have wrong knowledge, then you can get something also. You can destroy your karmas and get the liberation, whatever. You cannot get prema. And so if you want to get prema, realize the Lord in the spiritual world through chanting the name of the Lord, then you need proper knowledge. So that's why we do have books. That's why Prabhupada emphasized he keeps translating books until you read the books, because you get knowledge, you get proper guidance, so that when we chant, it has more power to bring us to Krishna. So therefore, we may not need diksha for chanting the holy name, but we need shiksha. We do need those teachings. And those teachings, of course, are in the books, but also through the acharyas, etc. And also individually through the devotee. They can deliver those messages in such a way that we can, you know, understand it with no mistakes or without misinterpretation. So even then, even for Nama, Harinam, there's necessity of guru as well. There has to be someone there to teach as well, to give guidance. So therefore, the statement is true in any sense, whether it's Diksha Guru, Vedic Guru, or non-guru, or Shiksha Guru, whatever. Some person is necessary to give proper guidance so we can attain the highest goal.
Okay. Any questions?
As you mentioned about, you know, the holy name can have its potency even though if it's not received from Diksha Guru,
yeah.
You can just hear it like how we all started. And and we see our parampara is also more shiksha based.
Yeah.
Having heard of that, then could you emphasize or tell us the requirement or why do we need the Diksha Guru then?
Why do we need Diksha Guru? Good question. So, yes, we see that in spite of the fact that Harinam is prominent, we still carry on Diksha. But if we look at Lord Chaitanya in his pastimes, he didn't really emphasize the Diksha much. He took Diksha, of course, in Gaya, and he came back, and then whatever. But mainly he was chanting Hare Krishna, Nam, etc., emphasizing that. And when he was going out, then they just Nam Kirtan, and they would, he encouraged everyone to chant like Jagai Madai, chant the holy name, whatever, like this. Went to South India, he was simply chanting, didn't initiate anybody at all. So Lord Chaitanya's emphasis was on Nama. So this was a new process in one sense, because previously the Vaishnava, Nam was not prominent. Nam Sankirtana was not the prominent process. The Lord Chaitanya that made it popular. Of course, there were a few other saints like Tukaram and other, you know, simultaneous Sankirtana, but before that, no. So what was the process for the Vaishnava? Deity worship. Pancharatri deity worship. So we see the Madhvas and the Shris, Sampradaya, and they concentrate on deity worship. So for the Pancharatri deity worship, you need the mantras. The Diksha mantras, which are secret, and you shouldn't tell them to other people. With those mantras, you worship Vishnu and whatever. So the sadhana was, we can say, Pancharatri deity worship, and to do that, the Diksha was necessary. We see even Gopu Kumar in Brihad Bhagavatam, and he gets the mantra from the Guru, the Diksha Guru, and he chants this mantra secretly. That's where he progressed for his whole lifetime of Brahma, or a day of Brahma, or so he was doing this. And then finally Narada Muni said, better do Nama. That was introduced later on. So previous to Lord Chaitanya, more or less it was all Diksha line in the Vaishnava Sampradaya. And they were just, you know, they would chant that mantra and worship the deity. With Lord Chaitanya, then we have the introduction of Harinam, which doesn't require Diksha. So we could say, well, then we should just ignore the Diksha completely. But we see in our Sampradaya that deities are quite prominent also. In spite of the fact that Nama is most prominent, we do have deities. And the associates of Lord Chaitanya had deities, Goswamis had deities, Vishnu Chakravarti had deity, Baladev Vidvusan had a deity also. So they all worship the deity also, so which means they also had to have Diksha as well. So, of course, in Nectar Devotion we find that there are five prominent angas of bhakti. One is Nam Sankirtan, another is hearing, Bhagavatam, another is deity worship, and Sadhu Sangha, and living in the Dham. So, deity worship is, we can say, there as well, but it's not the most prominent angas, but it's there usually in many, most cases. And therefore, for that, you need the Diksha. So therefore, we do have Harinam as a prominent process, but because most people should do deity worship, then they also have need Diksha. But still, as we see, Bhaktisiddhanta didn't really emphasize it in one sense, because he chased a Shiksha line rather than a Diksha line. Nevertheless, we see also even in the Gaudiya Math, then the Diksha Guru got prominence again. And that's carried over into ISKCON also. We give prominence to the Diksha Guru. Though technically we should give prominence to the Shiksha Guru as more important, because the Diksha Guru, his technical function is mantras for deity worship. That's the technical function. Now the Diksha Guru can function as a Shiksha Guru also, and that's what happens in ISKCON, but he could also function independently. So we kind of merge the two roles into one, more or less. But technically, the Diksha Guru, if he just does the mantra, fine, that's Diksha. And then we want Shiksha, maybe that Guru, maybe some other Guru. We need Shiksha from somewhere. We're chanting properly, advancing.
So when you say that, is it the Diksha Guru then who takes the responsibility of the disciple of taking him back to Godhead, or is it the Shiksha Guru?
It could be whatever you choose to give you, whoever offers that responsibility and whoever accepts that responsibility. It could be either, or both. Of course, we're thinking about, what about this lifetime, next lifetime, next lifetime? Then it'd be a different person each lifetime, no? So there's so many people responsible again.
When talking about living entities taking different bodies, Prabhupada uses the example of how your shirt has got a hand because your body has got a hand. Mm-hmm. So I was able to relate that example, because Jiva has a human body,
soul must have a human form.
Yes.
But then if you have an animal, you would have an animal form. Yes. That doesn't quite make too much sense, I don't think. I think in the general sense, of, because we the jiva has a form, he's a surupa, therefore there's a form here. That's as far as we can go, but to say it's particular, that may not make too much sense.
Jiva in the spiritual world does not necessarily have a human form. Like,
could have any form, then. Yeah. Oh, actually, in Brihad Bhagavatam describes there in, when Gopal Kumar goes to Vaikuntha and he's waiting outside the gate there, then he observes different people going in, and some of them, they start, we say, shape changing. They start turning into different forms. They get to become a bird or an animal or a tree or whatever they want to. They can just all sorts of things. Then they come back to the other form and go into the Vaikuntha gate or whatever it is. But they have the ability to change the forms also. Just for pastimes or for the pleasure of the Lord or whatever. But because they do have a sthayi bhava, generally that's their fixed, the main form is a particular form, and then they can change to other shapes as well. Because all spiritual is not limited like the material world. And they have what? Satya sankalpa. Whatever they desire can be manifested. So they can manifest any form they want.
So we can't say that living entity in the dog's body is also having a human. We can't say that.
No. Human form and the jiva, no. I don't think so.
Maharaj, since the animals do not have karma, as the soul...
They don't produce karma, but they have karmas from previous human births which are stuck on them. And then due to that, they will advance or whatever after some time, and then they become a human being, a human being, and they do more karmas, and then they become an animal again, and then they progress upwards again, you know. Yeah.
So while they're in animal form,
simple activity.
From
being a human being and doing so many simple activities, they get demoted because they don't deserve to be a human being anymore. Because they don't use their free will properly. So they become animal. They don't have to choose anymore. And then they wear off their karmas and they gradually rise up to human being. Then they have to choose again. If they miss choose, then they sink down again.
Maharaja, how do we distinguish these three levels of devotees? One is the Jnana Mishra Bhakta, Bhakti Vedantis, like in the first canto Narada Muni says, some Bhakti Vedantis came, and unalloyed pure devotees. So what are the distinguishing characteristics of these three?
Well, I think the Bhakti Vedanta and the unalloyed devotion, we can say, are the same thing in one sense. Basically, we have pure bhakti, or uttama bhakti, defined in nectar devotion as no other desire except the desire to please the Lord. But in sadhana, if we do that, obviously we have some unconscious desires are there or whatever. In prema, there's nothing. It's only desire for Krishna. But in sadhana, obviously we do have other desires. But nevertheless, Rupa Goswami says, in sadhana you can do uttama bhakti also. So this means that at least when we practice bhakti, we do not consciously desire material benefits. That's karma, nisra bhakti. Or we don't desire liberation. That's jnana nisra bhakti. So when we're performing bhakti, we're not asking the Lord for material benefits or liberation. We're simply trying to please the Lord. In our mind, of course, we do have some subtle desires here and there, whatever, but gradually those get dissipated. So that's what we call pure bhakti in sadhana. When it turns to prema, then it is literally pure. There are no unconscious desires for anything else. It's all, everything is for Krishna.
Uddhava is also referred to as Jnana Mishra Bhakta.
Who?
Uddhava?
No, Prahlad is sometimes. Uddhava is actually very high. He's so high that he's right next to Krishna, and he can come to Vrindavan and he can observe the people of Vrindavan and he can deliver a message to the gopis, you know, etc. So he's very, very high, actually, even though he's not a member of Vrindavan.
You mentioned about Brahma realized liberation. So if any of the jiva get that liberation, would they be able to attain bhakti after that?
After that? Generally, if they go for it, in other words, whatever you strive for, the Lord gives you that. And so if you strive for lifetimes to get that impersonal liberation, that's what the Lord gives you, and you're satisfied with that. So you don't go any further. And if you strive for bhakti and go to the spiritual world, and you want to be a servant of Vishnu, you strive for that. You're satisfied with Vishnu, and you don't want to go up to, you know, Ramloka or Goloka or whatever. And if you strive for Ramchandra for lifetimes and you achieve that, then you're satisfied with that. If you strive for Krishna, then you get that, and you're satisfied with that. So once you're out of the material body, basically you kind of fix your that particular level according to your previous sadhana. Of course, there's always a little flexibility because Krishna can do anything he wants, inspire you, or the great devotees also could influence. So it is possible that if you're in that Brahman, that someone could influence you. However, more possible and more advisable is that while you're still in the material body and you're stuck in Brahman and you're Brahman realized, that you get the mercy of Krishna or devotee, then you can become a great devotee. That's the case of Sukadeva. He was a Brahmavadi, fixed in Brahman. But he got the mercy of Vyasadeva and Krishna, and then he became the greatest devotee also.
In the Brahmajyoti as such, the jiva has, as you mentioned, is only conscious that he is conscious.
Maybe not even that he's conscious. Well, there's a little debate about this. What is that Brahman realization? So, like Shankara's followers say, it is mere consciousness, chinmatra. It is consciousness. So you're not conscious of a thing, even, because there's no other object there. So you're just conscious. But then, Vaishnavacharyas, like I think Ramanuja or Mother, say, that's not even possible. You cannot have consciousness if you're conscious of something. You can't be conscious of something. So that's an impossible state. So they reject that whole realization as being useless. So we accept it. We accept a little modified that is that Brahman realization, but at least you're probably conscious of yourself. I exist as some eternal substance beyond the limitations of, you know, material bodies, etc., something like that. So we accept that as one form of realization. But it's not exactly like the Mayavadi concept of just consciousness. It's an impossibility.
So at that time, the living entity does not have a spiritual body and is partially out of...
Well, he's got a sarup in the sense he's still a jiva. But he's not aware of, I have a particular form or I am conscious of a particular thing, because there's no other consciousness. I'm just conscious, that's all. So he's eternally peaceful.
From there, then how does he fall down? Because even when you read the verse, once his pious credits are over, he falls down.
No, it's not by pious credits you get there. It's by destroying your subtle body and everything. So Jiva Goswami says that generally the fall down will occur for a Jiva Mukta. They have a material body, they've got some realization of Brahman, and they can fall from that position. If they get out of the material body and they merge in Brahman, which is a much higher state, because they have to be fixed in that group, then they stay there.
So when Prabhupada mentions that he often quotes his verse, Padanti, the one, the category that you mentioned.
Yeah, Jiva Muktas. Yeah, that's how Vishwanath explains it. I think Jiva also explains it like that. That they fall down from there when they're in the material world.
What about the relationship with God? They never realize the relationship with the God?
Their relationship with God is a realization of their self, more or less. That's as far as they get. They're just some conscious thing there. So it's a realization of God in the most general sense of being spiritual, something is spiritual, not material.
Does this contradict Krishna's wish that all the jivas come back to him?
Well, they are with him because Brahman is part of God. But they desire that form, they get that form. According to his surrender, you get that result. You want to merge in God, he gives you that result, and you're just kind of merged in that general Brahman type state, which is part of God, but it's also, you know, the inferior part.
In Gita, Krishna says, whoever thinks of me at the time of death comes back to me. So someone wants to think of Krishna at the time of death just to go back to him. Is that mixed devotion? Or?
Well, in one sense, because it's like salokya or sarupya. Huh? So the real devotee does not demand these things, or is not so much interested. He's only interested in service. And as a result of that, the Lord does give him, you know, spiritual body, spiritual world, etc. But that's not the goal of the devotee. Huh? So, of course, even to aspire to think of the Lord when you're dying with some sort of material desire or not such pure devotion may be very difficult to do anyway. So you want to plan everything out, think of that, and then something else happens, and you can't think of that when you're dying, you know. So if you make all these plans, probably it's not going to work anyway. Like that automatic process, just like thinking, and then it probably won't work out. You'll probably get distracted and think of something else. Generally, we get when we're dying, we got either one thing, we're so overcome by that state in terms of fear or confusion or whatever, that we have no control of our thought process at that time, really. Yeah? Or we maybe die unconscious, and just die with no thoughts, you know, blank state of mind. So to actually think of the Lord when you're dying in a very positive way is quite rare and quite difficult to do. Per person.
Also in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the start of the sadhana bhakti section, Rupa Goswami quotes that tasmat ke nabhi upayana mana krishna.
Yes. Even in hatred.
Yes, so does it mean that out of the 64 items of devotional service, Krishna likes smaranam most? Why is that verse?
Well, of course, we have this idea that actually all angas of bhakti are meant for remembering the Lord and not forgetting Him. So in one sense, everything is related to smaranam, which we say is the mind or whatever function of the mind, but ultimately is also the jiva. Huh? So all of the activities we do, whether it is atmanivedana, smaranam, or archana, it has an element of fixing the mind on the Lord. All these different things have an idea of fixing the mind on the Lord. There's a big debate in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita there, where the people of Tapaloka, who are basically meditators, and they're just in the mind saying, smaranam is superior to everything else. But then later on, the conclusion is that smaranam and kirtana go together, and they reinforce each other. So there's no rejection of smaranam as being very high, but it goes along with the process that they encourage each other. So the better you do smaranam, the better you can chant. The better you chant, the better you can fix your mind. The two things are, they cooperate with each other and produce good results for us. Okay, Hare Krishna.